Now, in December 1952, the Great Smog gripped London, and the smog was more than just bad fog, it was toxic, and eventually killed around 12,000 people. The city came to a halt, but there was another killer also at work, John Reginald Christie, who murdered at least six women. Kate Winkler-Dawson is the author of Death in the Air. Kate, good afternoon to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So who was John Reginald Christie? Tell us something about him.
Well, he was a quiet, unassuming man, which is, of course, how most people describe serial killers. He was a government worker and was married for 25, 30 years to the same woman. And, you know, he had a really rough childhood, in his opinion, at least. He was ostracized when he was younger by women, and he had an abusive father, an overbearing mother. And then I just had real trouble in his teens. And then during World War One, he was gassed by mustard gas and lost part of his voice. So he had this sort of squeaky voice and he was unattractive. So this bitterness sort of came out of him later in life. But at the time period when he started killing people in Notting Hill in London, he, like I said, was a government worker, and he was just sort of the strange neighbor who you either were creeped out by or just simply forgot. He sort of faded into the wallpaper, and I don't think anybody would have ever suspected that he was a serial killer who stashed bodies all through his house and in his back garden.
Now, I said at least six women. What might be the upper number on that?
Well, you know, he was always very vague. He really enjoyed the publicity once this came out and he went on the run and he became the beast of Rillington Place. But ultimately, one of the interesting parts of this story is he had a neighbor named Timothy Evans who had a wife and child, a 13-month-old little girl, and they moved into the flat just two floors above Christie and his wife. And at this point, this was 1949, John Christie, unbeknownst to anyone, had become a serial killer and had been killing women. So he had two women buried in the backyard, in his back garden. So when this couple moved in, they had a lot of marital trouble and the husband was abusive and the wife and the child went missing. And the husband, Timothy Evans, went home to Wales and confessed and said, "I did it. And here's where you can find them." And, eventually, he recanted and said, "My neighbor, John Christie, did it." No one believed him. Christie was a War Reserve police officer. And you know, for Notting Hill, which was a poverty-stricken area in the 1950s, Christie was a kind of an upstanding citizen. So nobody believed him. And Christie actually testified against Timothy Evans, who was eventually found guilty and hanged. So 3 years later, when Christie killed his wife, just a few days after the fog, and then sort of went on a short killing spree of three more women and hid them in the cupboard of his flat. He went on the run. The bodies were discovered. They started, you know, pulling bodies out of the backyard, skeletons out of the backyard, and women out of the house. And the newspaper headlines really kind of exploded with stories about him. I think the police all of a sudden thought, well, okay, hang on. We just hanged someone a couple of years ago for killing a little girl and a woman in the same building. And no one believed that there could be two killers living in the same building at the same time. And I think that is sort of the narrative in the UK, is that Timothy Evans was wrongfully executed. And it's actually considered one of the most prominent cases of wrongful conviction and execution, and led eventually to the abolishment of the death penalty in the UK in 1960. So it's a fascinating case.
Why did Evans confess to the crime then?
You know, we don't know. The issue with both of these men, because they both confessed to killing Burl Evans and Geraldine Evans. They both confessed, then they both recanted, and then they both confessed, and it just went back and forth. And, you know, we're just not sure. There have been allegations of police intimidation, but he literally walked into his hometown in Wales and into the police station and confessed. And part of it, I think, was a letter that his mother sent to his aunt and uncle in Wales from London and said, he's a liar. I know he said he came and visited his family. I never saw him. And somehow he felt caught. And so he went in and confessed, and then he recanted, and it just kept going back and forth. So you're talking about two very unreliable sources with these men, two men who have shown to be violent in the past. They both had motivation because Christie was a sexual predator and Evans was violent with his wife on occasion. So you just don't know. They were both liars, and that's what it comes down to.
Now, one of the many interesting aspects that you point up in the book is that while the Great Smog killed 12,000 people, the way that was reported and Christie's crimes were reported, there was quite a distinct difference there.
That's right. So for about the first third of the book, John Reginald Christie is just another person stuck in the fog trying to make his way around. And of course, there's no worse news for a serial killer than being trapped in your house with your wife for 5 days. And so, you know, once we get out of the fog and the real sort of exploration of the number of deaths in Parliament begins, then, you know, I started looking at the headlines in 1953, desperately searching for information on the fog, thinking, of course, this is going to lead the headlines. At the time, they thought 4,000 dead, which is an extraordinary number. But it wasn't. It just was back page news, if it was mentioned at all, or it was in the summaries of parliamentary arguments for that day. And instead, starting in about March 1953, when John Christie went on the run and they discovered all these bodies, it was just everywhere, full page spreads, you know, all these intricate interviews with neighbors. And then when he was caught and arrested, it just continued through the whole summer until he was executed with details about his trial. I'm a true crime aficionado, and I was a true crime TV producer, and I've made documentaries. And so it takes a lot to surprise me, and the details of this case surprised me. So I can totally understand why this enthralled the press, both in the UK and in the United States and all over the world. You know, Christie did really odd things, you know, like his dog unearthed one of the skeletons, at least part of one of the skeletons in his back garden. And he just picked up the femur bone and used a fence to prop it up. And the police looking for, at this point, Burl Evans and the little girl, walked right past it. It was very odd. I mean, you know, who else? He wallpapered three women into his coal cupboard. And I laugh. It's not funny, but it's so absurd. You just don't really encounter killers like this. And his personality was extraordinary. And I think when he was in prison and he finally was getting this attention that he had never received before, it was the highlight of his life. Yeah. Certainly. So it became frustrating for me, though. I couldn't get any information. I just started to realize that in the United States, and certainly in most countries, these sort of salacious stories, and in our case, of course, all the politics happening here, and every time someone tweets something here, it distracts the press and distracts the public from
I don't know who you could be referring to.
Who knows?
How long did it take the authorities to accept that the smog was actually the real killer? Well, I mean, not that Christie wasn't a killer, but was a mass killer.
Well, it took a long time. I mean, this was a constant fight. So to sort of frame the narrative here, we're talking about 1952 London, 7 years after the end of World War II. It was a shell-shocked city. You know, there were remnants of buildings from bombings everywhere. And the British government was bankrupt and wouldn't admit it. This is Churchill's government. And they did pretty much everything possible to avoid making any kind of change to industry. And simply, they couldn't afford smokeless fuel. It was too expensive. Coal was the only option. And they were also shipping off all of the, you know, quote unquote, clean coal, the black coal, over, and Londoners were forced to burn all this nasty brown coal that took, you know, about three quarters of the amount of amount to be able to create the same warmth as clean coal. So, you know, it was this perfect storm of things happening. And right, I mean, I think that the Churchill's cabinet was just praying that this would all blow over and they would never have another event like this again. And there was never another event this serious, but it certainly, over the next 6 months, over the summer of 53, and when there was a committee formed and came back with all of these recommendations for smokeless zones throughout London, it caught people's attention. But I'll give you an example. So a very similar incident happened in the United States 4 years earlier in Denora, Pennsylvania in 1948. This was caused by U.S. Steel's zinc factories in this small town, and an anticyclone, much like the one that landed over London, landed over Denora, created the seal, trapped all the pollution. 20 people died. Thousands were sickened, but 20 people died. There's a museum dedicated to this incident in Denora, and nothing like that in London. And I think that it was just difficult to accept that these sort of innocent London fogs actually killed so many people, because it wasn't a flood. There weren't people laying in the streets. It wasn't an earthquake where it was the damage was so visible. It was just another typical London fog that lasted a little longer, and there really wasn't even panic. Once the death toll really came out, I think it was just a byproduct of living in the most industrialized city in the world and the most populated at the time city in the world. So I think part of the attitude was, well, listen, if you don't like it, you can go ahead and move to the countryside.
Kate, thanks very much for speaking with us today. That's Kate Winkler Dawson, the author of Death in the Air: The True Story of a Serial Killer, The Great London Smog, and The Strangling of a City. We're going to take a break after that. The Star That Eats Planets.